What took place and the background for it most definitely does offer lessons for today's crises, as participants in the October 2002 retrospective insisted. While this may well have been the most dangerous moment in human history, it is not the only such case of flirting with catastrophe. More generally, it is far from the only illustration of unanticipated and unpredictable consequences of the resort to, or even the threat of, force, among the many reasons why sane people understand it to be a last resort, facing a very heavy burden of proof. Other lessons bear directly on conflicted U.S. relations with Europe, another topical matter at the anniversary meeting. The missile crisis suggests some reasons why Europeans might be wary of the U.S. political leadership. In that case, not radical right nationalists, but those at the liberal, multilateral end of the political spectrum. Europe's fate was hanging in the balance, as the president and his advisors decided to reject what they feared would be regarded as a fair trade if it were known. That Europe was kept in the dark and treated with disdain. Kennedy's XCOM summarily dismissed any idea of sharing with the Allies decisions that could have led to the nuclear destruction of Western Europe as well as North America, Frank Castigliola writes in a rare study of the topic. Kennedy told his Secretary of State privately that allies must come along or stay behind. We cannot accept a veto from any other power. Words heard again 40 years later from Bush and Powell. The U.S. commander of NATO put its air forces on alert without consultation with Europe. Kennedy's closest ally, British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, told his associates that Kennedy's actions were escalating into war, but he could do nothing to stop it. He knew only what he could learn from British intelligence. Washington's perception of the U.S.-UK's special relationship was articulated by a senior Kennedy advisor in internal discussion at the peak of the crisis. Britain will act as our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner. McGeorge Bundy suggested that some effort be made to encourage Europeans to feel they're a part of it, feel that they know, but only in order to keep them quiet. Europeans are not capable of the rational and logical approach of American decision makers, his aide Robert Comer advised. If European leaders found out what was happening, Bundy added, they might make noise, saying they can live with Soviet medium-range ballistic missiles. Why can't we? The word noise connotes discordant, unintelligent clamor, Castigliola adds. Perhaps many Europeans might not be too happy about the significance accorded their survival, even if respected U.S. commentators are confident that their reluctance to come along is a sign of paranoid anti-Americanism, ignorance and avarice, and other cultural deficiencies. International terrorism dominated the headlines as the retrospective conference took place. So did Washington's allegedly novel doctrine of regime change. But there is little novel here. The Cuban Missile Crisis grew directly out of a campaign of international terrorism aimed at forceful regime change. Historian Thomas Patterson concludes, quite plausibly, that the origins of the October 1962 crisis derived largely from the concerted U.S. campaign to quash the Cuban Revolution by violence and economic warfare. We can gain a better insight into current implications by looking at how the crisis evolved and the guiding principles that motivated policy. International terrorism and regime change, Cuba. The Batista dictatorship was overthrown in January 1959 by Castro's guerrilla forces. In March, the National Security Council, NSC, considered means to institute regime change. In May, the CIA began to arm guerrillas inside Cuba. During the winter of 1959 and 1960, there was a significant increase in CIA-supervised bombing and incendiary raids piloted by exiled Cubans based in the U.S. We need not tarry on what the U.S. or its clients would do under such circumstances. Cuba, however, did not respond with violent actions within the United States for revenge or deterrence. Rather, it followed the procedure required by international law. In July 1960, Cuba called on the UN for help, providing the Security Council with records of some 20 bombings, including names of pilots, plane registration numbers, unexploded bombs, and other specific details, alleging considerable damage and casualties, and calling for resolution of the conflict through diplomatic channels. U.S. Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge responded by giving his assurance that the United States has no aggressive purpose against Cuba. 4 months before, in March 1960, his government had made a formal decision in secret to overthrow the Castro government, and preparations for the Bay of Pigs invasion were well advanced. Washington was concerned that Cubans might try to defend themselves. CIA Chief Alan Dulles therefore urged Britain not to provide arms to Cuba. His main reason, the British ambassador reported to London, was that this might lead the Cubans to ask for Soviet or Soviet bloc arms. A move that would have a tremendous effect, Dulles pointed out, allowing Washington to portray Cuba as a security threat to the hemisphere, following the script that had worked so well in Guatemala. Dulles was referring to Washington's successful demolition of Guatemala's first democratic experiment, a 10-year interlude of hope and progress, greatly feared in Washington because of the enormous popular support reported by U.S. intelligence and the demonstration effect of social and economic measures to benefit the large majority. The Soviet threat was routinely invoked, abetted by Guatemala's appeal to the Soviet bloc for arms after the U.S. had threatened attack and cut off other sources of supply. The result was a half-century of horror, even worse than the U.S.-backed tyranny that came before. For Cuba, the schemes devised by the Doves were similar to those of CIA Director Dulles. Warning President Kennedy about the inevitable political and diplomatic fallout from the planned invasion of Cuba by a proxy army, Arthur Schlesinger suggested efforts to trap Castro in some action that could be used as a pretext for invasion. One can conceive a black operation in, say, Haiti, which might in time lure Castro into sending a few boatloads of men onto a Haitian beach in what could be portrayed as an effort to overthrow the Haitian regime. Then the moral issue would be clouded, and the anti-U.S. campaign would be hobbled from the start. References to the regime of the murderous dictator Papadoc Duvalier, which was backed by the U.S. with some reservations, so that an effort to help Haitians overthrow it would be a crime. Eisenhower's March 1960 plan called for the overthrow of Castro in favor of a regime more devoted to the true interests of the Cuban people and more acceptable to the U.S., including support for military operation on the island and development of an adequate paramilitary force outside of Cuba. Intelligence reported that popular support for Castro was high, but the U.S. would determine the true interests of the Cuban people. The regime change was to be carried out in such a manner as to avoid any appearance of U.S. intervention because of the anticipated reaction in Latin America and the problems of doctrinal management at home. The Bay of Pigs invasion came a year later, in April 1961, after Kennedy had taken office. It was authorized in an atmosphere of hysteria over Cuba in the White House. Robert McNamara later testified before the Senate's Church Committee. At the first cabinet meeting after the failed invasion, the atmosphere was almost savage, Chester Bowles noted privately. There was an almost frantic reaction for an action program. At an NSC meeting 2 days later, Bowles found the atmosphere almost as emotional and was struck by the great lack of moral integrity that prevailed. The mood was reflected in Kennedy's public pronouncements. The complacent, the self-indulgent, the soft societies are about to be swept away with the debris of history. Only the strong can possibly survive, he told the country, sounding a theme that would be used to good effect by the Reaganites during their own terrorist wars. Kennedy was aware that allies think that we're slightly demented on the subject of Cuba, a perception that persists to the present. Kennedy implemented a crushing embargo that could scarcely be endured by a small country that had become a virtual colony of the U.S. in the 60 years following its liberation from Spain. He also ordered an intensification of the terrorist campaign. He asked his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, to lead the top-level interagency group that oversaw Operation Mongoose, a program of paramilitary operations, economic warfare, and sabotage he launched in late 1961 to visit the terrors of the earth on Fidel Castro, and more prosaically, to topple him. The terrorist campaign was no laughing matter, Jorge Dominguez writes in a review of recently declassified materials on operations under Kennedy, materials that are heavily sanitized and only the tip of the iceberg, Piero Iglesias adds. Operation Mongoose was the centerpiece of American policy toward Cuba from late 1961 until the onset of the 1962 missile crisis, Mark White reports, the program on which the Kennedy brothers came to pin their hopes. Robert Kennedy informed the CIA that the Cuban problem carries the top priority in the United States government. All else is secondary. No time, no effort, or manpower is to be spared in the effort to overthrow the Castro regime. The chief of Mongoose operations, Edward Lansdale, provided a timetable leading to open revolt and overthrow of the communist regime in October 1962. The final definition of the program recognized that final success will require decisive U.S. military intervention after terrorism and subversion had laid the basis. The implication is that U.S. military intervention would take place in October 1962, when the missile crisis erupted. In February 1962, the Joint Chiefs of Staff approved a plan more extreme than Schlesinger's, to use covert means to lure or provoke Castro or an uncontrollable subordinate into an overt hostile reaction against the United States, a reaction which would in turn create the justification for the U.S. to not only retaliate, but destroy Castro with speed, force, and determination. In March, at the request of the DoD Cuba Project, the Joint Chiefs of Staff submitted a memorandum to Defense Secretary Robert McNamara outlining pretexts which they would consider would provide justification for U.S. military intervention in Cuba. The plan would be undertaken if a credible internal revolt is impossible of attainment during the next 9 to 10 months, but before Cuba could establish relations with Russia that might directly involve the Soviet Union. A prudent resort to terror should avoid risk to the perpetrator. The March plan was to construct seemingly unrelated events to camouflage the ultimate objective and create the necessary impression of Cuban rashness and responsibility on a large scale, directed at other countries as well as the United States, placing the U.S. in the apparent position of suffering defensible grievances and developing an international image of Cuban threat to peace in the Western Hemisphere. Proposed measures included blowing up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay to create a Remember the Maine incident, publishing casualty lists in U.S. newspapers to cause a helpful wave of national indignation, portraying Cuban investigations as fairly compelling evidence that the ship was taken under attack, developing a communist Cuban terror campaign in Florida and even in Washington, using Soviet bloc incendiaries for cane-burning raids in neighboring countries, shooting down a drone aircraft with a pretense that it was a charter flight carrying college students on a holiday, and other similarly ingenious schemes. Not implemented, but another sign of the frantic and savage atmosphere that prevailed. On August 23rd, the President issued National Security Memorandum No. 181, a directive to engineer an internal revolt that would be followed by U.S. military intervention, involving significant U.S. military plans, maneuvers, and movement of forces and equipment that were surely known to Cuba and Russia. Also in August, terrorist attacks were intensified, including speedboat strafing attacks on a Cuban seaside hotel, where Soviet military technicians were known to congregate, killing a score of Russians and Cubans, attacks on British and Cuban cargo ships, the containment of sugar shipments, and other atrocities and sabotage, mostly carried out by Cuban exile organizations permitted to operate freely in Florida. A few weeks later came the most dangerous moment in human history. Terrorist operations continued through the tensest moments of the missile crisis. They were formally canceled on October 30th, several days after the Kennedy and Khrushchev agreement, but went on nonetheless. On November 8th, a Cuban covert action sabotage team dispatched from the United States successfully blew up a Cuban industrial facility, killing 400 workers, according to the Cuban government. Raymond Garthoff writes that the Soviets could only see the attack as an effort to backpedal on what was, for them, the key question remaining, American assurances not to attack Cuba. These and other actions reveal again, he concludes, that the risk and danger to both sides could have been extreme and catastrophe not excluded. After the crisis ended, Kennedy renewed the terrorist campaign. 10 days before his assassination, he approved a CIA plan for destruction operations by U.S. proxy forces against a large oil refinery and storage facilities, a large electric plant, sugar refineries, railroad bridges, harbor facilities, and underwater demolition of docks and ships. A plot to kill Castro was initiated on the day of the Kennedy assassination. The campaign was called off in 1965, but one of Nixon's first acts in office in 1969 was to direct the CIA to intensify covert operations against Cuba. Of particular interest are the perceptions of the planners. In his review of recently released documents on Kennedy-era terror, Dominguez observes that only once in these nearly 1,000 pages of documentation did a U.S. official raise something that resembled a faint moral objection to U.S. government-sponsored terrorism. A member of the NSC staff suggested that it might lead to some Russian reaction, and raids that are haphazard and kill innocents might mean a bad press in some friendly countries. The same attitudes prevailed throughout the internal discussions, as when Robert Kennedy warned that a full-scale invasion of Cuba would kill an awful lot of people and were going to take an awful lot of heat on it. Terrorist activities continued under Nixon, peaking in the mid-1970s with attacks on fishing boats, embassies, and Cuban offices overseas, and the bombing of a Cuban airliner, killing all 73 passengers. These and subsequent terrorist operations were carried out from U.S. territory, though by then they were regarded as criminal acts by the FBI. So matters proceeded. While Castro was condemned by editors for maintaining an armed camp, despite the security from attack promised by Washington in 1962. The promise should have sufficed, despite what followed, not to speak of the promises that preceded, by then well documented, along with information about how well they could be trusted, like the Lodge moment of July 1960. On the 30th anniversary of the missile crisis, Cuba protested a machine gun attack against a Spanish-Cuban tourist hotel. Responsibility was claimed by a group in Miami. Bombings in Cuba in 1997, which killed an Italian tourist, were traced back to Miami. The perpetrators were Salvadoran criminals operating under the direction of Luis Posada Carriles and financed in Miami. One of the most notorious international terrorists, Posada had escaped from a Venezuelan prison where he had been held for the Cuban airliner bombing with the aid of Jorge Mascanosa, a Miami businessman who was the head of the tax-exempt Cuban-American National Foundation, CANF. Posada went from Venezuela to El Salvador, where he was put to work at the Ilopango military base to help organize U.S. terrorist attacks against Nicaragua under Oliver North's direction. Posada has described in detail his terrorist activities and the funding for them from exiles and CANF in Miami, but felt secure that he would not be investigated by the FBI. He was a Bay of Pigs veteran, and his subsequent operations in the 1960s were directed by the CIA. When he later joined Venezuelan intelligence with CIA help, he was able to arrange for Orlando Bosch, an associate from his CIA days, who had been convicted in the U.S. for a bomb attack on a Cuban-bound freighter, to join him in Venezuela to organize further attacks against Cuba. An ex-CIA official familiar with the Cubana bombing identifies Posada and Bosch as the only suspects in the bombing, which Bosch defended as a legitimate act of war. Generally considered the mastermind of the airline bombing, Bosch was responsible for 30 other acts of terrorism, according to the FBI. He was granted a presidential pardon in 1989 by the incoming first Bush administration after intense lobbying by Jeb Bush and South Florida Cuban-American leaders overruling the Justice Department, which had found the conclusion inescapable that it would be prejudicial to the public interest for the United States to provide a safe haven for Bosch because the security of this nation is affected by its ability to urge credibly other nations to refuse aid and shelter to terrorists. Cuban offers to cooperate in intelligence sharing to prevent terrorist attacks have been rejected by Washington, though some did lead to U.S. actions. Senior members of the FBI visited Cuba in 1998 to meet their Cuban counterparts, who gave the FBI dossiers about what they suggested was a Miami-based terrorist network, information which had been compiled in part by Cubans who had infiltrated exile groups. 3 months later, the FBI arrested Cubans who had infiltrated the U.S.-based terrorist groups. Five were sentenced to long terms in prison. The national security pretext lost whatever shreds of credibility it might have had after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, though it was not until 1998 that U.S. intelligence officially informed the country that Cuba no longer posed a threat to U.S. national security. The Clinton administration, however, insisted that the military threat posed by Cuba be reduced to negligible, but not completely removed. Even with this qualification, the intelligence assessment eliminated a danger that had been identified by the Mexican ambassador in 1961, when he rejected JFK's attempt to organize collective action against Cuba on the grounds that if we publicly declare that Cuba is a threat to our security, 40 million Mexicans will die laughing. In fairness, however, it should be recognized that missiles in Cuba did pose a threat. In private discussions, the Kennedy brothers expressed their fears that the presence of Russian missiles in Cuba might deter a U.S. invasion of Venezuela. So the Bay of Pigs was really right, JFK concluded. The first Bush administration reacted to the elimination of the security pretext by making the embargo much harsher, under pressure from Clinton, who outflanked Bush from the right during the 1992 election campaign. Economic warfare was made still more stringent in 1996, causing a furor even among the closest U.S. allies. The embargo came under considerable domestic criticism as well, on the grounds that it harms U.S. exporters and investors, the embargo's only victims, according to the standard picture in the U.S. Cubans are unaffected. Investigations by U.S. specialists tell a different story. Thus, a detailed study by the American Association for World Health concluded that the embargo had severe health effects, and only Cuba's remarkable healthcare system had prevented a humanitarian catastrophe. This has received virtually no mention in the U.S. The embargo has effectively barred even food and medicine. In 1999, the Clinton administration eased such sanctions for all countries on the official list of terrorist states, apart from Cuba, singled out for unique punishment. Nevertheless, Cuba is not entirely alone in this regard. After a hurricane devastated West Indian islands in August 1980, President Carter refused to allow any aid unless Grenada was excluded as punishment for some unspecified initiatives of the reformist Maurice Bishop government. When the stricken countries refused to agree to Grenada's exclusion, having failed to perceive the threat to survival posed by the nutmeg capital of the world, Carter withheld all aid. Similarly, when Nicaragua was struck by a hurricane in October 1988, bringing starvation and causing severe ecological damage, the current incumbents in Washington recognized that their terrorist war could benefit from the disaster, and therefore refused aid, even to the Atlantic coast area with close links to the U.S. and deep resentment against the Sandinistas. They followed suit when a tidal wave wiped out Nicaraguan fishing villages, leaving hundreds dead and missing in September 1992. In this case, there was a show of aid, but hidden in the small print was the fact that apart from an impressive donation of $25,000, the aid was deducted from assistance already scheduled. Congress was assured, however, that the pittance of aid would not affect the administration's suspension of over $100 million of aid because the U.S.-backed Nicaraguan government had failed to demonstrate a sufficient degree of subservience. U.S. economic warfare against Cuba has been strongly condemned in virtually every relevant international forum, even declared illegal by the Judicial Commission of the Normally Compliant Organization of American States. The European Union called on the World Trade Organization to condemn the embargo. The response of the Clinton administration was that Europe is challenging three decades of American-Cuban policy that goes back to the Kennedy administration and is aimed entirely at forcing a change of government in Havana. The administration also declared that the WTO has no competence to rule on U.S. national security or to compel the U.S. to change its laws. Washington then withdrew from the proceedings, rendering the matter moot. Successful defiance. The reasons for the international terrorist attacks against Cuba and the illegal economic embargo are spelled out in the internal record. And no one should be surprised to discover that they fit a familiar pattern, that of Guatemala a few years earlier, for example. From the timing alone, it is clear that concern over a Russian threat could not have been a major factor. The plans for forceful regime change were drawn up and implemented before there was any significant Russian connection, and punishment was intensified after the Russians disappeared from the scene. True, a Russian threat did develop, but that was more of a consequence than a cause of U.S. terrorism and economic warfare. In July 1961, the CIA warned that the extensive influence of Castroism is not a function of Cuban power. Castro's shadow looms large because social and economic conditions throughout Latin America invite opposition to ruling authority and encourage agitation for radical change, for which Castro's Cuba provided a model. Earlier, Arthur Schlesinger had transmitted to the incoming President Kennedy his Latin American mission report, which warned of the susceptibility of Latin Americans to the Castro idea of taking matters into one's own hands. The report did identify a Kremlin connection. The Soviet Union hovers in the wings, flourishing large development loans and presenting itself as the model for achieving modernization in a single generation. The dangers of the Castro idea are particularly grave, Schlesinger later elaborated, when the distribution of land and other forms of national wealth greatly favors the propertied classes, and the poor and underprivileged, stimulated by the example of the Cuban Revolution, are now demanding opportunities for a decent living. Kennedy feared that Russian aid might make Cuba a showcase for development, giving the Soviets the upper hand throughout Latin America. In early 1964, the State Department Policy Planning Council expanded on these concerns. The primary danger we face in Castro is in the impact the very existence of his regime has upon the leftist movement in many Latin American countries. The simple fact is that Castro represents a successful defiance of the U.S., a negation of our whole hemispheric policy of almost a century and a half. To put it simply, Thomas Patterson writes, Cuba, as symbol and reality, challenged U.S. hegemony in Latin America. International terrorism and economic warfare to bring about regime change are justified not by what Cuba does, but by its very existence, its successful defiance of the proper master of the hemisphere. Defiance may justify even more violent actions, as in Serbia, as quietly conceded after the fact, or Iraq, as also recognized when pretexts had collapsed. Outrage over defiance goes far back in American history. 200 years ago, Thomas Jefferson bitterly condemned France for its attitude of defiance in holding New Orleans, which he coveted. Jefferson warned that France's character is placed in a point of eternal friction with our character, which, though loving peace and the pursuit of wealth, is high-minded. France's defiance requires us to marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation, Jefferson advised, reversing his earlier attitudes, which reflected France's crucial contribution to the liberation of the colonies from British rule. Thanks to Haiti's liberation struggle, unaided and almost universally opposed, France's defiance soon ended, but the guiding principles remain in force, determining friend and foe. Guiding principles. The principles illustrated in the missile crisis explain why international law is irrelevant. Domestic law was also declared irrelevant. Rejecting a 1961 legal brief that held the Bay of Pigs invasion to be a violation of U.S. neutrality laws, Attorney General Robert Kennedy determined that the U.S.-run forces were patriots. Therefore, none of their activities appeared to be violations of our neutrality laws, which clearly were not designed for the kind of situation which exists in the world today. The world did not suddenly become extraordinarily dangerous on 9/11, requiring new paradigms that dismantle international law and institutions, and grant the White House the power to disregard the domestic rule of law. The achievements of international terrorism are excluded from sanitized history, but they are recognized with pride by the perpetrators. The famous School of the Americas, which trains Latin American officers to carry out their missions, proudly announces as one of its talking points that the U.S. Army helped to defeat liberation theology, the heresy to which the Latin American church succumbed when it adopted the preferential option for the poor and was made to suffer its own terrors of the earth for this departure from good order. Symbolically, the grim decade of Reagan-Bush terror was opened, shortly before they took office, by the assassination of a conservative Salvadoran archbishop who had become a voice for the voiceless, with thinly veiled complicity of the U.S.-backed security forces. And the decade closed with the murder of 6 Jesuit Salvadoran intellectuals whose brains were blown out, and their housekeeper and her daughter murdered, by an elite Washington-armed and trained battalion that had already compiled a record of bloody atrocities. The significance of these events in Western culture is illustrated by the fact that the work of these troublesome priests is unread and their names unknown, in sharp contrast to their counterparts under Kremlin rule. They were thus doubly assassinated, murdered, and forgotten. In fact, their corpses received another kick in the face. Immediately after the murders, Vaclav Havel visited Washington to speak at a joint session of Congress, where he received a standing ovation for praising the defenders of freedom, who, he and his audience surely knew, had armed and trained the assassins of the 6 leading Latin American intellectuals, while leaving a bloody trail of the usual victims. His praise for our glorious selves after these achievements won rapturous acclaim from leading liberal commentators, who saw in it more signs that we are entering a romantic age, as Anthony Lewis called it, and were awed by his voice of conscience that speaks compellingly of the responsibilities that large and small powers owe each other, according to the Washington Post editors. But not the responsibility that the U.S. owes to the people of Central America, at least those who survived the murderous onslaught of the 1980s. In the case of Cuba, successful defiance elicited reactions that brought the world close to destruction. But that is unusual. Successful defiance has regularly been overcome by one or another form of violence without any risk to the perpetrators. One strategy from the early 1960s was the installation of neo-Nazi national security states, which had as their goal to destroy permanently a perceived threat to the existing structure of socio-economic privilege by eliminating the political participation of the numerical majority, that is, the popular classes. The move set off a plague of repression and terror throughout the continent, reaching Central America during the Reaganite phase of the current political leadership. The plague began with a military coup in Brazil, set in motion before Kennedy's assassination and carried out shortly after. Washington cooperated with the military forces that overthrew parliamentary democracy in recognition of their basically democratic and pro-United States orientation, Kennedy's ambassador Lincoln Gordon explained. While the torturers and assassins were carrying out their work, Gordon hailed the most decisive victory for freedom in the mid-20th century. The Democratic Rebellion, Gordon cabled Washington, would help in restraining left-wing excesses of the former moderate populist elected government, and the Democratic forces now in charge should create a greatly improved climate for private investment. Gordon's view was endorsed by other leading figures of the Kennedy-Johnson administrations, though by the 1980s, as in Chile at the same time, the Brazilian generals were happy to transfer the wreckage to civilian hands. Despite the enormous advantages of the Colossus of the South, the generals had left Brazil in the same category as the less developed African or Asian countries when it came to social welfare indices, malnutrition, infant mortality, etc., with conditions of inequality and suffering rarely matched elsewhere, but a grand success for foreign investors and domestic privilege. These patterns have not been restricted to the domains of the Monroe Doctrine. To take one of many examples from other parts of the world, while Washington was facilitating the Democratic Rebellion in Brazil and seeking to overcome Cuba's efforts to take matters into its own hands, elder statesman Ellsworth Bunker was sent to Indonesia to investigate troubling conditions there. He informed Washington that the avowed Indonesian objective is to stand on their own feet in developing their economy, free from foreign, especially Western, influence. A national intelligence estimate in September 1965 warned that if the efforts of the mass-based PKI to energize and unite the Indonesian nation succeeded, Indonesia would provide a powerful example for the underdeveloped world and hence a credit to communism and a setback for Western prestige. That threat was overcome a few weeks later by a mass slaughter in Indonesia and then the installation of the Suharto dictatorship. From the 1950s, fear of independence and excessive democracy permitting a popular party of the poor to participate in the electoral arena, had been driving factors in Washington's exercises of subversion and violence, much as in Latin America. Cuba's crimes became still more immense in 1975 as it extended its reach to Africa, serving as the instrument of Russia's crusade to dominate the world, Washington proclaimed. If Soviet neocolonialism succeeds in Angola, UN Ambassador Daniel Patrick Moynihan thundered, the world will not be the same in the aftermath. Europe's oil routes will be under Soviet control, as will the strategic South Atlantic, with the next target on the Kremlin's list being Brazil. The theme is again familiar, with changes in the cast of characters. Washington's fury was roused by another Cuban act of successful defiance. When a U.S.-backed South African invasion came close to conquering newly independent Angola, Cuba sent troops on its own initiative, scarcely even notifying Russia, and beat back the invaders. The South African press warned of the blows to South African pride and the boost to African nationalism which has seen South Africa forced to retreat by black Cuban soldiers. South Africa's major black newspaper wrote that black Africa is riding the crest of a wave generated by the Cuban success in Angola and tasting the heady wine of the possibility of realizing the dream of total liberation. The defense of Angola was one of Cuba's most significant contributions to the liberation of Africa. How remarkable these contributions were unknown before Gleizes' groundbreaking work appeared, telling the story of a small country's vision of defying a big power's oppression, and, thanks to extraordinary individual heroism and self-sacrifice, changing a continent. Gleizes observes that Kissinger did his best to smash the one movement that represented any hope for the future of Angola, the MPLA. And though the MPLA bears a grave responsibility for its country's plight in later years, it was the relentless hostility of the United States that forced it into an unhealthy dependence on the Soviet bloc and encouraged South Africa to launch devastating military raids in the 1980s. The many campaigns of international terrorism and economic warfare to overcome successful defiance and left-wing excesses, adopting the philosophy of the new nationalism and perhaps even influenced by liberation theology, barely sampled here, are considered insignificant or perhaps obviously legitimate, as are their bitter consequences. Accordingly, they scarcely enter the enormous current literature and public discussion of international terrorism and Washington's supposedly new doctrine of regime change. At worst, they can be dismissed with comforting euphemisms. An occasional casual reference tells us that nothing happened in Cuba beyond the destabilization campaign known as Operation Mongoose. And fortunately, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, leftist terrorism has all but dried up. North Korea and Cuba are no longer as busy promoting disorder as they once were. Cuba is listed prominently in scholarly work on terrorism, but typically as a suspect in the crime, not a victim. Reagan-Bush international terrorism in Nicaragua and elsewhere does not exist, or is at worst traceable to inattention or some other understandable departure from the mission assigned by Providence to the leaders of the idealistic New World bent on ending inhumanity. And the persistence of standard operating procedures after the Cold War also did not occur or doesn't matter. The overriding principle prevails. Misdeeds are performed by others. We are culpable only for inadvertent error or oversight. It is of the utmost significance for the future that in a world dominant power, even the worst crimes are easily effaced. The wars in Indochina are a remarkable example. After years of brutal destruction, much of the U.S. population had come to oppose the wars on principled grounds. Among educated elites, however, objections were typically on narrow grounds of cost and failure. We may concede that there were some flaws in our generally praiseworthy effort, notably My Lai. When Americans look back with sadness and even shame at the Vietnam War, it is horrors like the My Lai massacre they have in mind, Jean Bethke Elstein writes, the only Vietnam example mentioned in her furious denunciation of the crimes of others. My Lai is convenient because the massacre can be blamed on half-educated GIs trying to survive in awful conditions in the field, unlike, say, Operation Wheeler Wallowa, to which My Lai was a minor footnote, one of the many post-Tet mass murder operations planned by respectable people just like us, so that we need feel no shame, even sadness, over these huge crimes. Cuba was added to the official list of terrorist states in 1982, replacing Iraq, which was removed so as to make Saddam Hussein eligible for U.S. aid. International terrorism and regime change, Nicaragua. It is instructive to look at another international terrorist campaign to overcome successful defiance, the terrorist war against Nicaragua. The case is particularly illuminating because of the scale of the terrorist campaigns aimed at regime change, the role of the current Washington leadership in executing them, and the way that they were cast when in progress and reshaped in retrospect within the intellectual culture. The case has further significance because it is so uncontroversial in the light of the judgments of the highest international authorities. Uncontroversial, that is, among those who have a minimal commitment to human rights and international law. There is a simple way to estimate the size of that category. Determine how often these elementary matters were discussed, even mentioned, in respectable circles in the West, most dramatically after the War on Terror was redeclared on 9/11. From that exercise alone, one can draw some conclusions about the future, not very optimistic ones. The attack against Nicaragua was one of the highest priorities of the War on Terror launched as the Reagan administration came into office in 1981, targeting primarily state-sponsored terrorism. Nicaragua was an unusually dangerous agent of the plague because it was so close to home, a cancer right here in our landmass, openly renewing the goals of Hitler's Mein Kampf, Secretary of State George Shultz declared to Congress. Nicaragua was armed by the Soviet Union, which had implanted there a privileged sanctuary for terrorists and subversives just 2 days' driving time from Texas, the president warned. A dagger pointed at the heart of Texas, to paraphrase an illustrious predecessor. This second Cuba would become a launching pad for revolution up and down, first of all Latin America, then who knows where. Nicaraguan communists have threatened to carry their revolution into the United States itself. Soon we may see Soviet military bases on America's doorstep, a strategic disaster. Despite the immense odds he faced, the president bravely told reporters, "I refuse to give up. I remember a man named Winston Churchill who said, 'Never give in, never, never, never. So we won't.'" Reagan declared a national emergency because the policies and the actions of the government of Nicaragua constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States. Explaining the bombing of Libya in 1986, Reagan announced that the mad dog Gaddafi was sending arms and advisors to Nicaragua to bring his war home to the United States, part of his campaign to expel America from the world. Particularly ominous was Nicaragua's Revolution Without Borders, regularly brandished though it had immediately been exposed as a fraud. The source was a speech by Sandinista leader Tomas Borge, explaining that Nicaragua hoped to develop successfully and provide a model for others who would have to follow their own paths. The speech was transmuted by Reaganite public diplomacy into a design for world conquest and faithfully relayed by the media. Even more interesting than the antics of a political leadership seeking to set new records for absurdity and deceit are the actual contents of the documents subjected to State Department manipulation. Borges' words probably did strike terror in the hearts of Reagan's planners. They understood very well that the real threat is successful development that might infect others, renewing the danger of Guatemala's crushed experiment with democracy and social reform, Cuba's successful defiance, and many other examples, back to the days when the American Revolution terrified the Tsar and Metternich. The threat had to be recast in terms of aggression and terror for the purposes of public diplomacy. Pursuing that vocation, Secretary of State Shultz warned that terrorism is a war against ordinary citizens. As he spoke, U.S. planes were bombing Libya, killing dozens of ordinary citizens. The bombing was the first terrorist attack in history scheduled for primetime TV, exactly when all major networks opened their evening news, no small technical feat given the logistical difficulties. Shultz warned particularly of the Nicaraguan cancer, announcing that we must cut it out, and not by gentle means. Negotiations are a euphemism for capitulation if the shadow of power is not cast across the bargaining table, Shultz orated, condemning those who advocate utopian legalistic means like outside mediation, the United Nations, and the World Court, while ignoring the power element of the equation. Washington forcefully blocked such utopian means, beginning with the efforts of Central American presidents to bring a negotiated peace to the region in the early 1980s. Washington proceeded to cut the cancer out by violence and, not surprisingly considering the array of forces, with great success. The leading academic historian of Nicaragua, Thomas Walker, points out that after a few years, Washington's terrorist war had reversed the considerable economic growth and social progress that followed the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship, driving the highly vulnerable economy to disaster, so that the country achieved the unenviable status of being the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere by the time the administration had achieved its goals. One component of the triumph, Walker continues, was a death toll that would be comparable to 2.25 million dead in the U.S. relative to population. Reagan State Department official and historian Thomas Carruthers observes that for Nicaragua, the toll in per capita terms was significantly higher than the number of U.S. persons killed in the U.S. Civil War and all the wars of the 20th century combined. Destruction of Nicaragua was a task of no slight importance. The country's progress during the early 1980s was lauded by the World Bank and other international agencies as remarkable and laying a solid foundation for long-term socioeconomic development, according to the Inter-American Development Bank. In the health sector, the country enjoyed one of the most dramatic improvements in child survival in the developing world, according to UNICEF in 1986. The real cancer feared by the Reaganites was thus serious. Nicaragua's remarkable transformation could have metastasized to a revolution without borders, in the sense of the speech that was reshaped for propaganda purposes. It was therefore only logical, from Washington's point of view, to eradicate the virus before it could infect others, who must in turn be inoculated by terror and repression. Like Cuba, Nicaragua did not respond to terrorist attack with bombings in the U.S., efforts to assassinate the political leadership, and other such measures, which, we are solemnly informed, meet the highest standards when conducted by our leaders. Rather, it approached the World Court for relief. Its legal team was led by the distinguished Harvard University law professor Abram Shays. Expecting that the U.S. would abide by a court decision, the team prepared a very narrow case, restricted to terrorist acts that required scarcely any argument, because they were conceded, mining of Nicaraguan harbors in particular. In 1986, the court found in Nicaragua's favor, dismissing U.S. government claims and condemning Washington for unlawful use of force, international terrorism in lay terms. The court ruling went beyond Nicaragua's narrow charge, reiterating more forcefully earlier decisions. The court ruled any form of intervention prohibited if it interferes with the sovereign right of choice of a political, economic, social, and cultural system and the formulation of policy. Intervention is wrongful when it uses methods of coercion in regard to such choices. The judgment applies to many other cases. The court also defined humanitarian aid explicitly, ruling all U.S. aid to the Contras strictly military, hence illegal. U.S. economic warfare was also ruled in violation of valid treaties, therefore unlawful. The decision had little detectable effect. The World Court was condemned as a hostile forum by the editors of the New York Times, and therefore irrelevant, like the UN. Legal authorities, noted for their defense of world order, dismissed the ruling on grounds that America needs the freedom to defend freedom, according to Thomas Frank, as it was doing in devastating Nicaragua and much of the rest of Central America. Others condemned the court because of its close ties to the Soviet Union, according to Robert Lycan of the Washington Post, a claim not worthy of refutation. Subsequent aid to the Contras was uniformly described as humanitarian in violation of the explicit court ruling. Congress immediately approved an additional $100 million to escalate what the court had condemned as the unlawful use of force. Washington continued to undermine utopian legalistic means until it finally achieved its ends by violence. The World Court further ordered the U.S. to pay indemnities, and Nicaragua sought to estimate the costs under international supervision. Estimates were in the $17 to $18 billion range. The call for reparations was, of course, dismissed as ridiculous, though just to make sure, after the U.S. regained control, the Nicaraguan government was heavily pressured to abandon the claims for reparations mandated by the court. Interestingly, the figure of $17 billion is the amount that Iraq has paid to people and companies in compensation for its invasion of Kuwait. The numbers killed in the Iraqi conquest of Kuwait appeared to be on the order of the U.S. invasion of Panama a few months earlier, hundreds or thousands, according to various estimates, a fraction of the deaths in Nicaragua, and perhaps 5% of those killed in the U.S.-backed Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. There is, of course, no thought of compensation in such cases. Another relevant comparison in terms of compensation is Vietnam. Here, attitudes vary, as usual, from doves to hawks. At the dovish extreme, President Carter assured Americans that we owe Vietnam no debt and have no responsibility to render it any assistance because the destruction was mutual. Others thought we should not be so soft-hearted. Taking a moderate view, neither hawk nor dove, President Bush Sr. announced that it was a bitter conflict, but Hanoi knows today that we seek only answers without the threat of retribution for the past. The crimes the Vietnamese committed against us can never be forgotten, but we can begin writing the last chapter of the Vietnam War if they dedicate themselves with sufficient zeal to the MIAs, the sole moral issue that remains after an invasion that left millions dead and three countries in utter ruins, with unknown numbers still dying from unexploded ordnance and the massive chemical warfare attack against the South. The North was spared this particular horror. The adjacent front page story in the New York Times reports Japan's failure, once again, to unambiguously accept blame for its wartime aggression. Given that the invaders were the victims, the Vietnamese are responsible for reparations. Vietnam was therefore compelled to pay to the U.S. the huge debt incurred by the Saigon government that the U.S. had installed as its local agent for its wars in Indochina, which targeted primarily South Vietnam. Clinton, however, magnanimously advocated a plan to allow Vietnam to use some portion of its debt to the U.S. for educational purposes. Clinton's plan was modeled on a 1908 program that returned to China a portion of its indemnity it was forced to pay for rebelling against its foreign masters, the Boxer Rebellion. There are earlier precedents. Haiti's liberation from French rule in 1804 shocked civilized opinion, which feared that the virus of liberation might spread from the first free nation of free men. For obvious reasons, the danger was particularly acute in the U.S., which took the lead in isolating the criminal state, relenting only in 1862 when destinations were being sought for freed slaves. Liberia was recognized in the same year. In punishment for the crime of liberation, Haiti was compelled to pay France a huge indemnity in 1825, which guaranteed French domination and had a catastrophic effect on the society that France had devastated in the War of Liberation in its richest colony. Half a century before France's punishment of Haiti for its successful defiance, George Washington set forth in 1779 on the conquest of the advanced Iroquois civilization. His goal was to extirpate them from the country, he wrote to Lafayette on the 4th of July, and to expand American boundaries westward toward the Mississippi. Conquest of Canada was barred by British force. The town destroyer, as Washington was known to the indigenous population, completed his mission successfully. The Iroquois were then informed that they would have to provide compensation for their treacherous resistance to their liberators. Another Clinton, then governor of New York, informed the defeated tribes that, considering our losses, the debts we have incurred in our former friendship, it is reasonable that you make to us a cession of your lands as will aid us in repairing and discharging the same. Having little choice, the Iroquois ceded their territory, only to discover that New York State proceeded at once to violate its solemn treaties and the prohibitions of the Articles of Confederation and to take most of the rest through threats, deception, and guile. A young American soldier later wrote home that, I feel really guilty as I applied the torch to huts that were homes of content until we ravagers came spreading desolation everywhere, but perhaps in a good cause. Our mission here is ostensibly to destroy, but may it not transpire that we pillagers are carelessly sowing the seeds of empire? Following the U.S. rejection of the World Court orders, Nicaragua, still eschewing violent retaliation or threat of terror, took its case to the Security Council, which endorsed the court's judgment and called on all states to observe international law. The U.S. vetoed the resolution. Nicaragua then approached the General Assembly, which passed a similar resolution with only the U.S., Israel, and El Salvador opposed, and another the following year with only the U.S. and Israel opposed. Little of this was even reported, and the matter has disappeared from history. Washington's reaction to the orders of the World Court and the Security Council was to escalate the terrorist war, while also issuing official orders to its forces to go after soft targets and to avoid the Nicaraguan army. State Department spokesperson Charles Redmond confirmed and justified the new and more extreme terrorist programs, issuing a statement that would do credit to George Orwell's Ministry of Truth, America's Watch responded, adding that Redmond's conception of legitimate target would justify terrorist attacks on Israeli collectives or on U.S. civilian targets for that matter. New Republic editor Michael Kinsley criticized human rights organizations for becoming too emotional about State Department justifications for terrorist attacks on soft targets. We should instead adopt a sensible policy that meets the test of cost-benefit analysis, he advised, an analysis of the amount of blood and misery that will be poured in and the likelihood that democracy will emerge at the other end. Democracy, as U.S. elites understand the term, an interpretation illustrated quite clearly in the region. It is taken for granted that they have the right to conduct the analysis and pursue the project if it passes their tests. And it did pass their tests. In 1990, with a gun to their heads, as was clear to many impartial observers, Nicaraguans succumbed and voted to turn the country over to the U.S.-backed candidate. U.S. elites celebrated the triumph, entranced by the new romantic age. Commentators across the spectrum of respectable opinion enthusiastically lauded the success of the methods adopted to wreck the economy and prosecute a long and deadly proxy war, until the exhausted natives overthrow the unwanted government themselves with a cost to us that is minimal, leaving the victims with wrecked bridges, sabotaged power stations, and ruined farms, and thus providing the U.S. candidate with a winning issue. ending the impoverishment of the people of Nicaragua, according to Time magazine. We are united in joy at this outcome, proud of this victory for U.S. fair play, headlines in the New York Times proclaimed. The official policy of attacking soft targets relied on U.S. control of the skies over Nicaragua and the sophisticated communications equipment provided to the terrorist forces attacking from U.S. bases in Honduras. The Reagan administration tried the technique that was praised by CIA Director Alan Dulles in Guatemala and recommended for Cuba, pressuring allies to refuse requests for military aid so that Nicaragua would turn to the Russians for help and could then be portrayed as a tentacle of the Kremlin-sponsored conspiracy poised to destroy us. The Nicaraguan government did not rise to the bait, however. Reaganite propaganda therefore fabricated lurid tales about Soviet MiGs threatening the U.S. from Nicaraguan bases. That is not surprising. One expects systems of vast power to be committed to lying and deceit. But the reactions are more revealing. Hawks called for the bombing of Nicaragua in punishment for this new crime. Doves tended to be more cautious, questioning the reliability of the claims, but adding that if they were accurate, then we would have to bomb Nicaragua, because the planes would be capable against the United States, according to Senator Paul Tsongas. U.S. security would be at risk if the Nicaraguan Air Force obtained some vintage 1950s MiGs to defend its airspace. In contrast, there was no threat to Nicaragua's security when U.S. client forces attack undefended civilian targets under the guidance of U.S. planes that controlled the country's skies. Another example of logical illogicality. That Nicaragua might have the right to protect its airspace from ongoing U.S. terrorist attack is next to inconceivable. The thought was virtually never voiced, which is reasonable too, given the principle that U.S. actions are defensive by definition, so that any reaction to them is aggression, much like the internal aggression of the South Vietnamese in South Vietnam, assaulting the American defenders from the inside, in the rhetoric of Kennedy liberals. With Washington-style democracy and proper economic practice restored, the country sank more deeply into political and socioeconomic ruin, while attention lapsed in the U.S. A decade after the U.S. had regained control, half the economically active population had left the country, often the boldest, most capable, most determined, either legally or as illegal migrant workers. Their remittances, estimated at some $800 million annually, are what keep the damper down on uncontrollable social upheaval, a research journal of the Jesuit University reported. It also estimated that Nicaragua's gross domestic product would have to grow 5% annually for the next 50 years to reattain the productive levels of 1978. Before our historic underdevelopment was intensified to the extreme by the U.S.-financed war to destroy the revolution, by the wreckage left by subsequent globalization, and by the massive corruption of the post-1990 U.S.-backed governments. That issue of the journal appeared just as the U.S. suffered its first international terrorist atrocity on home soil. Another striking illustration of prevailing attitudes toward terrorism is the warning of Bush administration officials 2 months later that Nicaragua would be punished if its November 2002 election were to be won by the political forces that had dared to resist U.S. attack, the FSLN, and thus do not share the values of the world community. Washington cannot forget that Nicaragua ended up a refuge for violent political extremists in the 1980s. There is some truth to that. Managua did serve as a refuge for social democratic political leaders, poets and writers, prominent religious figures, human rights activists, and others fleeing the death squads and official security forces of the terrorist states installed and backed by Washington, rather as Paris became a refuge from fascism and Stalinism in the 1930s. We are reminded of the refuge daily by the continuing presence of some members of the FSLN leadership who perpetuated these abominations, the State Department warned Nicaraguan voters. Given their past record, why should we believe their statements that they have changed? We are confident that the Nicaraguan people will reflect on the nature and history of the candidates and choose wisely. Nicaraguans hardly needed the warnings. Their history sufficed to tell them that, should they misbehave by electing the wrong government, as they did in 1984 in an election that the U.S. refused to recognize because it could not control the outcome and has therefore been excised from history, then Nicaragua will again be considered a state that supports terrorism, with the penalties that ensue, which are not trivial. Citing Washington's cynical warnings, the editors of Envio observed that it is a safe bet that those who took up arms at a time when U.S. state terrorism was killing, torturing, forcing disappearances, and closing all political spaces, will now be reclassified as terrorists. The unimaginable and singular tragedy of September 11th surely felt like the end of the world in the targeted country, the editors observed. But Nicaragua experiences the end of the world nearly every day, after the destruction the U.S. government has repeatedly wreaked on this country and its people. The atrocities of 9/11 may be denounced as Armageddon, but Nicaraguans recall that their country lived its own Armageddon in excruciating slow motion under U.S. assault, and is now submerged in its dismal aftermath, having been reduced to the second poorest country in the hemisphere after Haiti, vying with Guatemala for the distinction, also enjoying perhaps the world record for concentration of wealth. Among the victors, all of this has been effaced in the classic fashion. Nicaragua and El Salvador are remembered as relative success stories, and precisely the kind of success stories we lack in the Middle East, to be remedied by the new crusade for democratization. One would be hard put to find a phrase within mainstream commentary suggesting that the record of international terrorism of current Bush administration officials might have some bearing on the war on terror they redeclared on 9/11. Among the leading figures of the redeclared war is John Negroponte, who ran the embassy in Honduras that was the main base for the terrorist attacks on Nicaragua. He was duly chosen to oversee the diplomatic component of the current phase of the war on terror at the United Nations. Its military component is run by Donald Rumsfeld, who was Reagan's special envoy to the Middle East during the period of the worst terror there, and was also delegated to establish firmer relations with Saddam Hussein. The Central American War on Terror was supervised by Elliot Abrams. After pleading guilty to misdemeanor counts in the Iran-Contra affair, Abrams received a Christmas Eve pardon from the first President Bush in 1992 and was appointed by the second Bush to lead the National Security Council's Office for Near East and North African Affairs, the senior director job that oversees Arab-Israeli relations and U.S. efforts to promote peace in the troubled region, a phrase drawn from Orwell in light of the record. Abrams is joined by Otto Reich, who is charged with running an illegal covert domestic propaganda campaign against Nicaragua, appointed temporary assistant secretary for Latin American affairs under the second Bush, then designated special envoy for Western Hemisphere affairs. To replace Reich as assistant secretary, the administration nominated Roger Noriega, who served in the State Department during the Reagan administration, helping forge fiercely anti-communist policies toward Latin America, in translation, terrorist atrocities. Secretary of State Powell, now cast as administration moderate, served as national security advisor during the final stage of the terror, atrocities, and undermining of diplomacy in the 1980s in Central America, and the support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. His predecessor, John Poindexter, was in charge of the Iran-Contra crimes and was convicted in 1990 of 5 felony counts, overturned mostly on technicalities. The second Bush placed him in charge of directing the Pentagon's Total Information Awareness Program, under which, the ACLU observes, every American, from the Nebraskan farmer to the Wall Street banker, will find themselves under the accusatory cyber stare of an all-powerful national security apparatus. The rest of the list is mostly similar. Nicaraguans were the lucky ones during the first phase of the war on terror. They at least had an army to defend them against state-sponsored terrorism. In neighboring states, the terrorists were the security forces. El Salvador became the leading recipient of U.S. military aid and training, Israel-Egypt aside, by the mid-1980s, as atrocities were peaking. Congress imposed human rights conditions on aid to Guatemala, compelling the Reaganites to resort to their international terror network to take over the task, including Argentine neo-Nazis until they were overthrown at home, Israel, Taiwan, and others experienced in counter-terror. The torture and destruction of the civilian population were consequently much worse. The editors of Envio add that in December 1989, the government of George Bush Sr. ordered the invasion of Panama, a military operation that bombed civilian neighborhoods and killed thousands of Panamanians, just to flush out a single man, Manuel Noriega. Was that not state terrorism? A fair question, though much stronger terms are used when those who lack the power to control history carry out such actions. Though disappeared by the victors in routine fashion, the crimes are not forgotten by their victims. Panamanians, too, while condemning the 9/11 attacks, recalled the death of perhaps thousands of poor people in the course of Operation Just Cause, undertaken to kidnap a disobedient thug who was sentenced to life imprisonment in Florida for crimes mostly committed while he was on the CIA payroll. One journalist remarked how much alike the victims of 9/11 are to the boys and girls, to the mothers and the grandfathers and the little old grandmothers, all of them also innocent, when the terror was called Just Cause and the terrorist called Liberator. Perhaps such memories help account for the remarkably low level of international support for the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. In Latin America, where there is the longest experience of U.S. violence, support was least, scarcely detectable. Latin Americans hardly have to be reminded by Carlos Salinas, former director of government relations for Amnesty International, that they know better than perhaps most people that the U.S. government is one of the biggest sponsors of terrorism. It is easy to dismiss the world as irrelevant or consumed by paranoid anti-Americanism, but perhaps not wise. Chapter 5, The Iraq Connection. After 8 years, more reactionary sectors of the Reagan-Bush administrations regained political power in the contested 2000 election. They recognized that the 9/11 atrocities provided them with an opportunity to pursue long-standing goals with even greater intensity, closely following the script of their earlier tenure in office. The script, international. For George Bush the Younger, PR specialists and speechwriters have constructed the image of a simple man with a direct line to heaven, who relies on his gut instincts as he strides forward to rid the world of evildoers while contemplating his visions and dreams. A caricature of ancient epics and children's tales, with an admixture of cowboy fiction. The first time around, the imagery constructed for the leader was not very different, and the rhetoric no less fevered. All states must band together to combat, according to Reagan, the evil scourge of terrorism, particularly state-backed international terrorism, a plague spread by depraved opponents of civilization itself in a return to barbarism in the modern age, said George Shultz. Important questions should have arisen at once. What constitutes terrorism? How does it differ from aggression or resistance? The operative answers are revealing, but the questions never entered the arena of public discussion. A convenient definition was adopted. Terrorism is what our leaders declare it to be, period. The practice continues as the war is redeclared. In the 1980s, the two main foci of the war on terror were Central America and the Mideast Mediterranean region. In Central America, as discussed, the war on terror instantly became a barbaric terrorist war, hailed as a grand success and discarded from history. In the Middle East, as we shall see, the commanders in Washington and their local associates were again responsible for crimes far exceeding anything charged to their official enemies. The facts are particularly noteworthy because the retail terror they were opposing was inflated by their propaganda systems to become the lead story of the year by the mid-1980s, an impressive achievement. Turning elsewhere, during the Reagan years, Washington's South African ally had primary responsibility for more than 1.5 million dead and $60 billion in damage in the newly liberated Portuguese colonies of Angola and Mozambique. A UNICEF study estimated the death toll of infants and young children in these two countries at 850,000, 150,000 in 1988 alone, reversing gains of the earlier post-independence years, primarily through the weapon of mass terrorism. That is putting aside South Africa's practices within its own borders, where it was defending civilization against the onslaughts of Nelson Mandela's African National Congress, one of the more notorious terrorist groups, according to a 1988 Pentagon report. Meanwhile, the Reaganites evaded sanctions, increased trade, and provided valuable diplomatic support for South Africa. One of the endeavors of the current incumbents has become well known: the success of the CIA and its associates during the 1980s in recruiting radical Islamists and organizing them into a military and terrorist force. The goal, according to Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was to draw the Russians into the Afghan trap, initially by secret operations that would induce them to invade Afghanistan. The Carter-Brzezinski reaction to the subsequent invasion was based on a complete misinterpretation of the Russian decision to intervene, according to the very knowledgeable analyst Raymond Gartoff. The Russian decision was undertaken reluctantly and with narrow and defensive objectives, as is now clearly established in the Soviet archives, he writes. For the Reaganites, who took over a year later, the single aim, he continues, was bleeding the Russians and pillorying the Soviets in world opinion. The immediate result was a war that devastated Afghanistan, with even worse consequences after the Russians withdrew and Reagan's jihadis took over. The long-term result was 2 decades of terror and civil war. In the 1980s, there was threat of worse, as CIA-backed incursions of Afghan guerrillas and saboteurs into Soviet territory nearly provoked a major Soviet-Pakistani, if not Soviet-American, war, with unforeseeable consequences. After the Russians withdrew, the terror organizations recruited, armed, and trained by the U.S. and its allies, among them Al-Qaeda and similar jihadis, turned their attention elsewhere, inflaming the India-Pakistan conflict with an unprecedented terrorist offensive in India in March 1993, and repeatedly bringing the region to the brink of nuclear war in later years as the flames spread. A month earlier, related groups had come close to blowing up the World Trade Center, following a formula taught in CIA manuals. The planning was traced to followers of Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, who had been helped to enter the U.S. and was protected within the country by the CIA. Other consequences around the world need not be reviewed. Also, at least partially familiar, is the long-standing support of the present incumbents for Saddam Hussein, often attributed to obsession with Iran. That policy continued without change after Iran's capitulation in the Iran-Iraq War, because of our duty to support U.S. exporters, the State Department explained in early 1990, adding the usual boilerplate about how aiding Saddam would improve human rights, regional stability, and peace. In October 1989, long after the war with Iran was over, and more than a year after Saddam's gassing of the Kurds, President Bush Sr. issued a national security directive declaring that normal relations between the United States and Iraq would serve our longer-term interests and promote stability in both the Gulf and the Middle East. He took the occasion of the invasion of Panama shortly after to lift a ban on loans to Iraq. The U.S. offered subsidized food supplies that Saddam's regime badly needed after its destruction of Kurdish agricultural production, along with advanced technology and biological agents adaptable to WMD. The warmth of the relations was indicated when a delegation of senators, led by Majority Leader and future Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole, visited Saddam in April 1990. They conveyed President Bush's greetings and assured Saddam that his problems did not lie with the U.S. government, but with the haughty and pampered press. Senator Alan Simpson advised Saddam to invite them to come here and see for themselves, to overcome their misconceptions. Dole assured Saddam that a commentator on Voice of America who had been critical of him had been removed. Saddam was not the only monster who won the acclaim of the current incumbents. Among others were Ferdinand Marcos, Baby Doc Duvalier, and Nicolae Ceaușescu. All were overthrown from within, despite strong U.S. support, until their fate was sealed. Other favorites included Indonesia's President Suharto, who competed with Saddam in barbarism. The first head of state honored with a visit to Bush the Elder's White House was Mobutu Sese Seko of Zaire, another high-ranking killer, torturer, and plunderer. The South Korean dictators also received Washington's strong support until U.S.-backed military rule was finally overthrown in 1987 by popular movements. Even minor thugs could be assured of a warm welcome as long as they were performing their function. Secretary of State Shultz was so enamored of Manuel Noriega that he flew to Panama to congratulate him after he had stolen an election by fraud and violence, praising the gangster for initiating the process of democracy. Later, Noriega lost his usefulness in the Contra War and other enterprises and was transferred to the category of evil, although, like Saddam, his worst crimes were behind him. He then became the target of invasion and kidnapping from the Vatican Embassy in Operation Just Cause, with consequences already mentioned. Some of these rulers easily matched Saddam in internal terror. Ceaușescu provides an instructive case. Under his rule, the population lived in terror of his dread security forces, renowned for their torture and barbarism. A week after he was overthrown in an unanticipated popular revolt in December 1989, the Washington Post described how he had destroyed the economic, intellectual, and artistic fabric of Romania, compiling a ghastly record in human rights. President George W. Bush spoke the truth when he made a Kennedy-esque appearance at Liberation Square in Bucharest, praising the nation that just 12 years ago deposed its own iron-fisted ruler, Nicolae Ceaușescu. It was a dramatic occasion. With a cold rain pelting his black raincoat and uncovered head, Bush said, "You know the difference between good and evil, because you have seen evil's face. The people of Romania understand that aggressive dictators cannot be appeased or ignored. They must always be opposed." The president and his admirers failed to mention just how his father and his own colleagues had honored the prescription that iron-fisted tyrants like Ceaușescu must always be opposed. The answer turns out to be a familiar one: by supporting them. We confront evil's face by lending it a willing hand, at least if there is something to gain. The immediate post-revolution Washington Post article just cited was correct in reporting that it is nice that President Bush Sr. has offered to establish diplomatic relations with Romania's hastily organized Council of National Salvation, but that does not absolve the West for its role in helping to maintain this tyrant in recent years, a message that seems to have gone the way of other unacceptable insights into the real world. In 1983, Vice President Bush expressed his admiration for Ceaușescu's political and economic progress and respect for human rights. 2 years later, Reagan's ambassador resigned because of Washington's objections to his concern for human rights. Shortly after, Secretary of State Schultz praised Romania as among the good communists, rewarding Ceausescu with a visit and economic favors. So matters continued until the tyrant was overthrown by Romanians, as in the case of other killers and torturers in the Reagan-Bush entourage. As soon as its favorite good communist was eliminated, Washington announced that a terrible burden had been lifted from Romania, while at the same time lifting its ban on loans to Saddam Hussein in order to achieve the goal of increasing U.S. exports and put us in a better position to deal with Iraq regarding its human rights record, the State Department explained with a straight face. As always, the U.S. leadership can confidently take credit for the overthrow of the tyrants it supported until the very end. Saddam Hussein has joined the pantheon of failed brutal dictators whom the U.S. has deposed, Donald Rumsfeld proudly announced, including Ceausescu in the pantheon. On the same day as Rumsfeld's declaration, Paul Wolfowitz explained that his love of democracy was honed during his formative years in the Reagan administration, when he was the State Department's chief Asia hand, praising the monstrous Suharto and supporting the brutal and corrupt Marcos, whose fall, he now claims, shows that democracy needs the prodding of the U.S., which backed Marcos until he could no longer be sustained in the face of popular opposition, joined even by the business classes and the army. The other examples are equally convincing. As the rogues gallery of past friends fades into oblivion, new favorites take their place. Among them, the Central Asian dictators, Uzbekistan's Islam Karimov, Turkmenistan's Sapir Murat Niyazov, and others, who were becoming even more brutal and repressive as they were welcomed as participants in the redeclared war on terror, also reinforcing the U.S. position in a region of considerable material wealth and strategic significance. Or, in another corner of the world rich in coveted oil, there is Teodoro Obiang of Equatorial Guinea, who ranks high in the competition among bloody tyrants and was duly received with full honors by President Bush in September 2002, shortly before he was re-elected to a seven-year term with 97% of the vote. An enthusiastic welcome has been extended to Algeria, which had already been singled out for praise by Clinton's State Department for its achievements in combating terror, meaning its horrendous record of state terrorist atrocities. Bush carried support for terror and torture to new extremes, offering military aid and other assistance to the Algerian government. Washington has much to learn from Algeria on ways to fight terrorism, we learn from William Burns, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East. Mr. Burns is right, Robert Fisk comments. America has much to learn from the Algerians, including the barbaric techniques of torture that Fisk and a few other journalists have been exposing for years, and that are now confirmed by Algerian army defectors in London and Paris. Up to 200,000 Algerians have been slaughtered in the 11 years since the military canceled that country's first democratic elections because an Islamist party won, Lisa Marlowe writes. If Algeria is the U.S. model for countering Islamic fundamentalism, heaven help us all. The sample above illustrates the consistency of the foreign policy record of the current incumbents. The domestic record displays a similar consistency. The script, domestic. The Reagan years saw a continuation of the relatively poor economic performance of the 1970s. Growth overwhelmingly benefited the very rich, unlike the golden age of the 50s and 60s, when it was evenly spread across the population. During the Reagan-Bush years, real wages stagnated or declined along with benefits, working hours increased, and employers were given free rein to ignore protection for labor organizing. The policies were, naturally, unpopular. As the first Bush administration reached its final days, Reagan was ranked alongside Nixon as the least popular living ex-president. It is not easy, under such conditions, to maintain political power. Only one good method is known: inspire fear. That tactic was employed throughout the Reagan-Bush years as the leadership conjured up one devil after another to frighten the populace into obedience. The threats to Americans during the first war on terror were immense. By November 1981, Libyan hitmen were roaming the streets of Washington to assassinate the president, who courageously faced down the scoundrel Gaddafi. From the first moment, the administration recognized Libya to be a defenseless punching bag, and therefore set up confrontations in which many Libyans could be killed, hoping for a Libyan response that could be exploited to induce fear. Before Americans could breathe a sigh of relief over the president's lucky escape from the Libyan hitmen, Gaddafi was on the march again, this time invading Sudan, across 600 miles of desert, with the air forces of the U.S. and its allies standing by helplessly. Gaddafi also allegedly concocted a plot to overthrow the government of Sudan, so subtle that Sudanese and Egyptian intelligence knew nothing about it, as discovered by the few U.S. reporters who took the trouble to investigate. The subsequent U.S. show of force enabled Secretary of State Shultz to announce that Gaddafi is back in his box where he belongs, because Reagan acted quickly and decisively, demonstrating the strength of the cowboy that so entranced worshipful intellectuals, Paul Johnson in this case. The episode was quickly relegated to oblivion once its purposes had been served. Just as the early Libyan threats subsided, another even more dangerous one appeared, an airbase in Grenada that the Russians could use to bomb us. Fortunately, our leader came to the rescue in the nick of time. After turning down offers for peaceful settlement on U.S. terms, Washington landed 6,000 elite forces who were able to overcome the resistance of a few dozen lightly armed middle-aged Cuban construction workers and were at last standing tall, the gallant cowboy in the White House proclaimed. But the threats were not over. Soon, Nicaraguans were looming on the horizon, only 2 days' driving time from Texas, waving their copies of Mein Kampf. Fortunately, the commander-in-chief, recalling Churchill's stand against the Nazis, refused to surrender and was able to fend off the threatening hordes, even though they were being supplied by Gaddafi in his campaign to expel America from the world. As the White House sought to mobilize congressional support for an intensified attack on Nicaragua in 1986, the Libyan threat was conjured up again with deadly U.S. provocations in the Gulf of Sidra, followed by the bombing of Libya on primetime TV, killing dozens on no credible pretext. The official stance was that Article 51 of the UN Charter accords us the right to use violence in self-defense against future attack. That was perhaps the first explicit formulation of the doctrine of preventive war, and the end of any hopes of a world of order and law, if taken at all seriously. And it was. New York Times legal analyst Anthony Lewis praised the Reagan administration for relying on a legal argument that violence against the perpetrators of repeated violence is justified as an act of self-defense. Imagine the consequences if others were powerful enough to adopt the Reagan-Lewis doctrine. So matters continued through the decade. The European tourist industry went into periodic decline, as Americans were too frightened to travel to European cities because they might be attacked by crazed Arabs or other demons. Grave threats were concocted at home as well. Crime in the U.S. is not very different from other industrial countries. Fear of crime, however, is much higher. The same is true of drugs. A problem in other societies, an imminent danger to our very existence in the U.S. It is easy for political leaders to use the media to whip up fear of these and other menaces. Campaigns are mounted periodically when required by domestic political needs. Bush Sr.'s racist Willie Horton escapade in the 1988 election campaign is a famous example. The September 1989 redeclaration of the drug war was another striking illustration. In the face of substantial evidence to the contrary, the administration dramatically proclaimed that Hispanic narco-traffickers were a menace to our society. Officials could be confident that the tactic would succeed, as explained by journalist and editor Hodding Carter, former Assistant Secretary of State in the Carter administration. "It's a lead pipe cinch," he wrote, "that the mass media in America have an overwhelming tendency to jump up and down and bark in concert whenever the White House, any White House, snaps its fingers." The campaign was a grand success. Apart from affecting drug use, fear of drugs instantly shot to the lead of public concerns. The stage was set for escalating the campaign to remove superfluous people from city streets to the new prisons that were rapidly being built, and to go on to Operation Just Cause, the glorious invasion of Panama on grounds of Noriega's involvement with drug trafficking, among other reasons. At the same time, the Bush administration was threatening Thailand with severe sanctions if it placed barriers on import of a far more lethal U.S.-produced substance, tobacco. But all this passed in silence. In the case of Panama, too, there was a knockdown legal argument for invasion. U.N. Ambassador Thomas Pickering instructed the Security Council that Article 51 of the U.N. Charter provides for the use of armed force to defend a country, to defend our interests and our people, and to prevent its territory from being used to smuggle drugs into the U.S., in this case by reinstating the white elite of bankers and businessmen, many of whom were themselves suspected of narco-trafficking and money laundering, and who soon lived up to their reputation, U.S. government agencies reported.